590. Council Stanford.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. Senate Bill 590 was before the committee on the 9th of May. It relates to the crime of criminal impersonation. ORS 162.365 creates a Class A misdemeanor for persons who injure, deceive, or defraud another, or who intend to obtain a benefit by falsely impersonating a public servant. The law defines public servant as an officer or employee of the state or any political subdivision of the state, an advisor, consultant, or assistant acting at the request of the state or any political subdivision of the state, a person nominated, elected, or appointed to a position but not yet filling the role, or jurors. If the public servant is a peace officer, judge, or justice of the peace, the offense is a Class C felony. Senate Bill 590 amends ORS 162.365 in the following ways. First of all, it adds to facilitate an unlawful activity to the intent options, rather than merely to intent to injure or defraud, etc. And it also includes then the impersonation of an active member or veteran of the armed forces of the United States. There was some discussion on the 9th of May at this hearing about existing law allowing a person to just merely intend to deceive and whether that was too broad. The Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 590 would eliminate the word deceive from existing ORS 162.365. As I should note that the subsequent statute, which I believe is 162.370, relates to it was done subsequently. It's the crime of criminal impersonation of a peace officer. The word deceive is eliminated from that subsequent statute. And so this would also eliminate the word deceive from 162.365.
Right. Committee, the purpose of this amendment is to make the bill accomplish, existing law, accomplish what was described as the intent of the existing law and this bill, which is that it would apply to somebody who is trying to use the impersonation of a public safety officer or of a member of the armed forces to gain some advantage, to defraud somebody or but not just pure deceit wouldn't be sufficient. And I believe that there's case law that applies it in that way. Council, am I remembering that correctly?
Chair McPherson, that's correct. Actually, a 1977 Oregon Supreme Court case.
So it's the way it's been interpreted, but it makes the language align with the way we think it was intended to work. We invite a motion on the Dash 1 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I'll move Dash 1s into Senate Bill 590.
Representative Barker moves the Dash 1 amendments into Senate Bill 590. For benefit of Representative Krieger, who's just joined us, this is the impersonation of a public safety officer or a member of the armed forces, and okay. The Dash 1 amendments have just been moved, which would remove the word deceive, which aligns it with what Senator Beyer presented us as the intent of, and in fact is the way the law has been interpreted in the past, but it lines it up so we don't have any issue about people being engaging in criminal conduct just because they dress up in a uniform without any intent to try to defraud people.
Halloween's all right.
Right. any discussion of the motion of the Dash 1 amendments? Any objection? Then the Dash 1 amendments are in the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 590 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Barker moves Senate Bill 590 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Bonamici.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Morris.
Excused.
Representative Paul.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Excused.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
Aye.
Chair McPherson.
Aye.
Senate Bill 590 moves to the as amended moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Barker or Representative Krieger, one of you would.
It's my bill. I mean, I'm on.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's right.
I didn't recall. Yes, yeah, Senator Representative Barker, if you would carry, I'd appreciate that.
Thank you.
Very good. Close the work session on Senate Bill 590. And is Senator Burdick in the room with us? There she is. Senator Burdick, I was going to go to the, you could go to either one, 573. You're going to present on both 573 and 694, right? Do you have a preference as to which one we open up first?
Pigs or pedestrians?
574?
694.
694, rather, I'm sorry. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 694A. Council Stanford.
Thank you, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. Senate Bill 694A relates to the restrictive confinement of pregnant pigs. Senate Bill 694A creates a Class A misdemeanor for the restrictive confinement of a pregnant pig if a person does each of the following elements. One, confines a pregnant pig. Two, for more than 12 hours in any 24-hour period. Three, in a manner that prevents the pig from lying down and fully extending its limbs or turning around freely, which is defined as being able to turn in a complete circle without an impediment, including a tether, and without touching any side of an enclosure. There are specific exceptions for a pregnant pig, that is, one, being transported, two, part of a rodeo or state or county fair, three, being slaughtered, four, part of lawful research, five, being examined by a veterinarian, or six, a pig in the seven-day period before the pig farrows, gives birth. Senate Bill 694A defines pig and turning around freely. It applies to the confinement of pigs after January 1st of 2012.
Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jenny Burdick, and I represent the people of Senate District 18. I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 694, which passed the Senate a couple of weeks ago. I was supposed to be joined today by one of my colleagues from the other side of the aisle, Senator Gary George, who testified very compellingly on the Senate floor in favor of this bill, but he is ill today. So I'm on my own. This bill, Senate Bill 694, sets a standard in Oregon for how we will care for animals raised for human consumption, specifically the 4,000 to 6,000 breeding sows in Oregon. Senate Bill 694 simply requires that pigs during pregnancy have enough room to engage in the most basic movements. This bill requires that a pig during pregnancy be given enough room to lie down, turn around, and extend her limbs. The practice of using two-foot-wide gestation crates restricts this movement. This bill does not impact the use of farrowing crates after the sow has given birth. It only affects the confinement of pigs during their pregnancy, which lasts about 4 months. Farrowing crates are slightly larger than gestation crates, allowing the sow to lie down and nurse piglets with slats on the side large enough for piglets to avoid crushing. These types of crates are not prohibited by the bill, and indeed some of the testimony in opposition to this bill was under the misguided assumption that it did apply to farrowing crates, and it does not. We learned a lot in the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing on this. A gestation crate is where some of the factory farms put pregnant sows for the 4 months of their pregnancy. These crates are 2 feet wide. This is what 2 feet looks like. This is the space that a 300 to 400 pound pregnant sow has to live in for 4 months during her pregnancy. She can't turn around, and in some cases, she can't lie down. We had compelling testimony when we had the hearing on this bill about the cruelty of these gestation crates and the impact it had on the sows. They developed joint problems, which were very painful. They developed psychosis from not being able to move around at all. But perhaps the most compelling testimony we received during the hearing was from a hog farmer who came to oppose the bill. And this fellow's name was Walter Burke, and he's been raising sows in the Gresham area for 26 years, and he described his practices. And when we got all done, we realized, and he realized, that his practices, which were very humane, he had a real respect for the animals who provided his livelihood, his practices were absolutely allowed in this bill because he uses farrowing crates, and many of the, probably most of the other hog farmers in Oregon use farrowing crates, which is where the pregnant sow goes 3 to 7 days before she gives birth. And these crates provide protection for the piglets, and they're large enough for the sow to lie down and nurse the piglets. And so they are, you know, they're short duration, and they have a legitimate use. They save the lives of the piglets because the sow is less likely to kill the piglet. A couple of states have adopted this restriction on gestation crates, Arizona and Florida. But they have done it by initiative. If Oregon adopts this, this will be the first time that a state legislature in this country has adopted it. The industry is moving, because of consumer outrage at this, at some of these practices, the industry is moving in this direction. Smithfield Farms has announced that they're going to phase it out. The reason I wanted Senator George here is that when we talk about bills like this, I think it's very important to understand that we are one state in Oregon. We are an rural state and an urban state, and we depend very heavily in this state on a healthy farming and ranching industry. We had nobody come to our hearing and defend the use of these gestation crates. I can't vouch for the fact that they're not being used in Oregon, but I can vouch for the fact that the hog farmers who came to testify at our hearings will not be adversely affected by this because it doesn't prevent the use of farrowing crates. I think I come from kind of the PR business in my day job, and I see a bill like this and a law like this as a real marketing opportunity for Oregon hog farmers. I know that once this bill becomes law, I will seek out Oregon-grown pork if I want to eat pork. And I'm not a vegetarian, but I really try to avoid, as many consumers do, the consumption of meat that where I'm not sure how the animal was treated. There's a great marketing opportunity for Oregon hog farmers. It makes sense, and it won't affect the responsible hog farming that's going on in Oregon today, but it may discourage industrial hog farms from coming in and trying to use these inhumane practices. So I strongly encourage, and I vote, we do have bipartisan support on this, and again, Senator George, in some ways, because of his experience in the agriculture industry, can speak even more compellingly, but he's unable to be here today, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
Very good. Any questions for Senator Burdick? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much, Senator Burdick, for bringing this before us. I have to admit it doesn't seem to be a big issue in my pretty urban, suburban district. But I have a question about this doesn't go into effect until 2012, and I wonder if that's because was there some sense that this is being done in Oregon and it's going to take some time for it to be implemented?
I think that was just a practical matter in case it was being done to give people a time to phase out. I'd rather have an emergency clause personally, but I think it was just a concession that if it is, to give people enough notice to allow them to do it. I don't think most of the farmers in Oregon will need that extended period. They'll just know they can't do it in the future.
Thank you.
Any further questions? If not, then thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you.
And I'll invite Kelly Peterson and Paul Shapiro forward.
Good morning, Chair McPherson and committee members. My name is Kelly Peterson, and I'm the Oregon Program Director for the Humane Society of the United States. And we're here today representing our 130,000 members and constituents here in Oregon. And really, at this point, I'm really happy to have another person who works for the Humane Society. He's the director of our family farming campaign, and he'll be presenting most of the testimony today, but we'll both be up here in case there are questions afterwards.
Thank you, Chairman McPherson and honorable members of the committee. I want to thank you for holding this important hearing and for giving us a chance to testify. My name is Paul Shapiro, and I represent the Humane Society of the United States. And on behalf of our more than 10 million supporters across the country, more than 130,000 of whom reside here in Oregon, I would like to urge you to please vote yes on SB 694. Now, you've received written testimony from farmers, from animal scientists, from veterinarians, encouraging a yes vote on this important bill, because the overwhelming majority of the scientific evidence on this topic demonstrates that Confining these animals in tiny crates where they're unable even to turn around is severely detrimental to their welfare. In fact, after the European Commission Scientific Veterinary Committee reviewed all of the literature on this topic, it concluded that the confinement of these breeding pigs in gestation crates was so inhumane that it ought to be banned and phased out. In fact, that is exactly what the European Union has done, and all 27 member nations have now banned this practice and are phasing them out. It's not only animal scientists and veterinarians on the other side of the Atlantic who are concerned about this cruelty, however. None other than probably the most renowned animal scientist in the United States, Dr. Temple Grandin, has spoken out against gestation crate confinement, stating, and I quote, "Gestation crates for pigs are a real problem. Basically, you're asking a sow to live in an airline seat. I think it's something that needs to be phased out." But it doesn't take an animal scientist or a veterinarian to know that confining a 500-pound social, intelligent animal in a 2-foot-wide crate where she can barely move for months on end is cruel and inhumane. This bill truly is a matter of common sense and basic decency. The only two times that American voters have had a chance to voice their concern about this issue, they voted overwhelmingly to ban gestation crate confinement. Both voters in Florida and Arizona, after having a measure on their ballot, voted to ban this cruelty. In Arizona, after a very aggressive and well-funded campaign by the industry, who was opposing it, voters still sided by a landslide margin on the side of common sense animal welfare policies by a margin of 62-38. In the wake of that Arizona vote, Smithfield Foods, the nation's largest pig producer, in fact the world's largest pig producer, announced that it would phase out its use of these gestation crates as well. Smithfield Foods counterpart in Canada, the largest pig producer in Canada, 1 week later announced that it too would end its use of gestation crates. In fact, more than half of all of Cargill's breeding sows now are no longer confined in gestation crates. And already fast food chains such as Chipotle and grocery stores and several grocery stores refuse to even carry pork from producers who use this confinement device. Even Burger King has stated that it is going to start buying pork from producers who don't use these gestation crates. In fact, Burger King's vice president of food safety was quoted as saying, "Our intent is to encourage animal agriculture to go in this direction." Wendy's followed suit, putting up a statement on its website stating, and I quote, that Wendy's agrees the recent industry efforts to move away from single-sow gestation crates is the right way to go, and we applaud their efforts. Wendy's will encourage its suppliers to adopt an ongoing plan to implement this practice. As Senator Burdick mentioned, there are very few defenders of this type of confinement. Even fast food chains such as Burger King and Wendy's and producers like Cargill and Smithfield are moving in the right direction. Now, it's certainly the case that a number of companies and animal scientists are concluding what common sense could already tell us, that confining these animals in 2-foot-wide crates is detrimental to their welfare. But corporate reform should not be a substitute for common sense public policies. The fact is that recent movement in the right direction still does not negate that the vast majority of breeding sows in our country are still confined in these 2-foot-wide crates. Our laws are a societal codification of our norms, and certainly it is worth codifying the norm that all animals, including those raised for food, deserve to be treated with common decency. Oregon legislators have a number of controversial bills pending before them, some certain to generate heated debate. But this issue is one that is so basic, so fundamental, that it truly deserves universal support from all legislators. We're thrilled that the Senate has voted 20-9 to pass this bill, and it's our hope that this committee will also support this common sense bill, because it truly is merely a matter of basic decency as to whether we allow these animals, from whom we take so much, just a little bit of space to be able to engage in the most basic behaviors. So please, on behalf of the Humane Society of the United States, we'd encourage you to vote yes on 694 and be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Are there questions for Mr. Shapiro? Representative Krieger. Why are you allowing the pig to be confined in that way that you say is inhumane for 12 hours?
I'm sorry, I couldn't catch your two sentences.
Why would you allow the pig to be confined in the inhumane way you described for 12 hours, as the bill says?
Yes, thank you. The question regarding the 12 hours is basically in there so that if a farmer needs to confine pigs for, let's say he's moving them around or he's separating pigs out or some other reason, that he has the ability to do that, and therefore you have you would have this type of gestation crate confinement still prohibited because they're permanent crates for these pigs for months on end. It's not like there are producers who are going to move them in and out of crates every 12 hours. But if a producer does feel the need to confine a pig for whatever reason, whether it's veterinary or, you know, they're vaccinating, et cetera, he or she would have the ability to do that.
Mr. Shapiro, did I understand from either from you or from Ms. Peterson that Oregon would be the first to be prohibiting this treatment among the states? Is that right?
I believe the senator is the one who mentioned that, but Oregon would be the first state to have representational government prohibit this confinement. Voters in Arizona and Florida have banned it by ballot initiative.
Representative Kump, did you have a question?
Go ahead.
I was going to ask about the question of using a misdemeanor sanction. I mean, assuming this is conduct that we want to regulate, is a criminal statute with a misdemeanor sanction is that being done anyplace else where it's been adopted by initiative, and is that, you think, the best way to go about what is essentially regulating a business practice?
Sure. Well, in Arizona, it is a criminal offense. Florida was actually an amendment to the state constitution. I think that for cases of cruelty to animals, criminal offenses do make sense. But prohibiting the cruelty, I think, is the aim of this bill. It's the primary aim, and by whatever means it is done, I think that so long as the intent of the bill to prohibit that type of intensive long-term confinement during the gestation period is what the bill is going at.
Chair McPherson, also there was a bill that was passed a couple sessions ago, and it included a banning of it was a downer bill, so you couldn't drag an animal that wasn't ambulatory, and that also was a Class A misdemeanor, and it was consistent with other practices, and so that's why it's also a Class A misdemeanor in here.
Representative Trump.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Shapiro, I'm just curious because I tend to be a researcher in nature, and I was looking at the references on your one handout, and you have references to your information as late as 2005 and clear back to 1976. I'm just curious, how do you obtain your data? Because people that do this type of treatment, they're not going to be filling out a survey and say, this is how I take or don't take care of our animals. So I'm just curious.
Thank you, Representative. I think it's a great question. It's the case today that there are not that many people who still defend the confinement of these animals in crates, but that hasn't been the case for a number of decades. The industry, up until recently, has been defending it, and there have been many producers who have been more than happy to admit that they keep their animals in 2-foot-wide crates, which is unfortunate. But most of our data is obtained by agricultural researchers who are either on our staff at the Humane Society of the U.S. or who are consultants to us. You're going to actually receive written testimony from Dr. Sarah Shields, who holds a PhD in animal science in favor of this bill, who is one of our top researchers on agricultural animal welfare.
Well, just a comment. My congratulations to the doctor, because there's a lot of education research that doesn't have near this much depth to it.
I'll pass your word along.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What happens to pigs when they're not pregnant? Are they crated in similar crates? Is this just to address the pregnant pigs, or are they all crated?
Well, most pigs who are used for food production are not crated. That is, only the breeding pigs are the ones who are crated. So if you have a farm where there are no breeding animals, you're probably not going to have crates. Now, for breeding pigs, when they're pregnant, typically they would be crated on a industrial-scale factory farm. After they, or right before they're given birth, they're moved into what's known as a farrowing crate, which is exempted from this bill. And that's about a three-week confinement as opposed to 4 months in the gestation crate. And the farrowing crate is where the sow nurses her piglets. After those piglets have been weaned, which is typically about 3 weeks, the sow will be moved back into a gestation crate, re-impregnated, and the cycle will go over again. And typically, they are giving birth about 2.5 times a year, and they are considered spent after only a few years because of this rigorous cycle of long-term intensive confinement.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair, because I have a farm background, thank you, but it might help the committee members that possibly haven't had this experience. The normal lifespan of most pigs is quite short because they grow very quickly, and I don't remember what that span is from birth to for us eating them. It's kind of disgusting,
yeah.
But
well, most pigs who are used for food are slaughtered at about 5 or 6 months of
age.
Yeah,
it's fast.
But you'll be hearing in a moment from a cattle rancher who also is part of a cooperative of hundreds of pig farms across the country in support of this bill, and I'm sure she can answer more questions related to the technicalities of pig farming.
Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How does this bill, or where does it say in here, farrowing crates are exempt? How do I know that?
Well, farrowing crates are only used for pigs who have given birth, and this bill only relates to pigs during pregnancy, and there's a one week window before giving birth where the pig can be moved into a farrowing crate and confined in a way that would otherwise be prohibited by this bill, but is exempted because of that window. But yeah, if you look at Section F, the 7-day period before the pig farrows.
Subsection 2.
Thank you.
Section F.
Go ahead.
But what if a farmer is using feral crates for the pregnancy or the I'm not a farmer either. Gestation period.
I will probably defer to Ms. Han Nyman, who's a cattle rancher and helps run a pig farming cooperative, to answer that. But farrowing crates are only used for farrowing purposes, for nursing, not while the pig is actually pregnant. But that said, if you read the language of the bill, it doesn't bring up the words farrowing crate and so on. It just says pigs during pregnancy must be able to turn around and extend their limbs and lie down. So even if they were, for some reason, using the wrong type of crate for the process, as long, you know, it wouldn't matter as far as this bill is concerned. What would matter is just whether the crate allowed sufficient room for the animal to turn around and extend her limbs.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Then we'll excuse these witnesses and hear from Dr. Larry Peets, Nicolette. Let's bring up a panel of three, Nicolette Han Nyman and Laura Ireland. Those are the order in which you are on the sign-up sheet, but if you have among yourselves a more logical order of based on what has been presented so far, I would invite you to present in different order.
Hi. Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Larry Peets, and I'm a veterinarian, native Oregonian. I've been in both large and small animal practice for many years. I grew up on a cattle ranch. I have a particular interest in this bill. I grew up in Tie Valley, Oregon, and we had my father and his brother had a ranch, and it was a little unusual at the time, but we had about 100 sows that we raised a lot of pigs when I was a kid. And I want to paint a little picture for you. Our, at that time, we raised, it was a pretty large production for that time. And we had, I remember my, we built straw farrowing huts for these sows out in the field where they would be, and they had free spaces to roam. They rooted, you know, did things that pigs do. And it's distressing to me when I think of these animals being confined for days on end and months on end in crates where they can not turn around or stand up. The basic humane, you know, levels of care. These animals live very much in the present moment. And when you think of days on ends of being confined, you know, it becomes, it's a matter of common sense that those animals are not enjoying life. And if we're going to make an ultimate sacrifice and eat them eventually, I think that they deserve just the basic level of care and treatment. I am encouraging you to pass this bill. Oregon has a long history of being ahead of the curve on issues such as this, and I think on social issues, and that we have an opportunity to, I guess, speak out for our citizens that you, that this makes a difference, how we treat animals that we're intending to consume. I'm not asking you to, you know, place human terms on this, but just basic, these animals live very much in the present moment, and they are, if they're confined and they can't move around at all, just the basic standards, it's distressing to me, and I would think it would be to you. I read a recent article. It was interesting, the representative that you said that your constituents being urban, you know, it wasn't a big issue. I would think that it is a big issue. I read an article just recently in Newsweek magazine where Wolfgang Puck, the famous chef, and his restaurants, they serve 5 million meals a year, and he's endorsing this type of treatment by people that he gets his suppliers of foods for his restaurants. So I think that the citizens will demand that this kind of treatment be implemented. So I would encourage you to support this, and it just makes common sense. I can't think of a reason why we wouldn't pass this. I'm sure there must be economic reasons that could be put forth, but I think it's important that we look beyond that and do what's right for the critters. So thank you, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Why don't we hear from the other two people at the table before we open it for questions?
Good morning. My name is Nicolette Hahn-Nyman, and as Paul Shapiro from Humane Society mentioned, I, together with my husband, I have a cattle ranch in Northern California. We are not hobby ranchers. We are full-time cattle ranchers. We both have other jobs as well because, as many farmers, we need to supplement our income with other work. I am also an attorney, and I worked for almost 10 years practicing law full-time before I began working on our ranch, before I married my husband, actually married into the ranching business. But we have a number of reasons. There are a number of reasons I traveled all the way to Oregon to speak on this very important bill that you're considering today. My husband, who unfortunately wasn't able to come today, I want to say a couple words about his background and kind of represent him as well. He began our farm about 35 years ago in Bolinas, California, and actually began as a pig farmer and raised only pigs and a few chickens and goats for a long time before getting into cattle. And he learned from neighbors and other farmers in the area how to raise pigs and also just use a lot of common sense and never used any form of crate, and found that the animals really thrived under those conditions. eventually, over time, my husband, whose name is Bill Nyman, established a company called Nyman Ranch, which today supplies not only Wolfgang Puck, but also many thousands of restaurants around the country use Nyman Ranch meat, and it is supplied entirely by a network of about 600 farmers, over 500 pig farmers, who all follow a certain set of welfare standards that were established by the Animal Welfare Institute. The Animal Welfare Institute standards do not allow any crates of any kind, neither farrowing nor gestation crates, and they have many other requirements about how the animal should be treated that we believe is actually the gold standard for animal welfare. But the important point in all of this is to stress that from a farming perspective, from a food production perspective, crates are absolutely unnecessary. They do, arguments can be made that they do reduce the costs, but they are absolutely unnecessary as far as the health of the animal and as far as having a viable and productive farming operation. And in fact, we feel they're absolutely counterproductive to all that, and that's why they're not allowed under our standards. In my own background is, as I mentioned, I was an attorney for 10 years, and 7 years ago I was hired by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to be his senior attorney for his national environmental organization, Waterkeeper Alliance. I began that job not knowing very much about how animals were raised in today's modern setting, but just knowing what kind of the ordinary citizen probably knows about how that's done. And Bobby Kennedy asked me to begin working full-time on the issue of animal confinement because it was such a major environmental issue. In fact, at that time, the Environmental Protection Agency had just made a declaration that it was that factory farms, as all of them together, not just pig farms, were one of the most important water pollution problems in the entire country. So I began working on this issue full time, and in the course of that job, I visited dozens of pig operations, and I've been to many. I've been inside and on the outside of, you know, over 100 pig operations, and I've been on dozens of the Nyman Ranch pig farms, none of which use crates. So I've seen the with crates, and I've seen without crates. And the message that I wanted to bring to you today, based on my experience working on our own ranch and based on the experience I've had reading and researching this issue for the past 7 years, as well as being on a lot of farms, is that farmers, as a general rule, do care about animals. And I especially believe that traditionally, there was a very strong connection between farmers and their livestock, and that what's happened is that the modern industrialized system has created a system where the animal is actually reduced to something where there's no longer that human-animal connection that has existed for thousands of years. We are, as Dr. Peets just said, we are asking the ultimate sacrifice of these animals. We are taking their lives for our nourishment. I believe in that. I don't have any moral or ethical qualms with taking the life of an animal for human food, but I firmly believe, and I believe that the 500 pig farmers in our network believe, that it is not ethical to force an animal to suffer for months on end before taking its life. In fact, I believe it is a gross violation of our duty to those animals of whom we ask the ultimate sacrifice. And I am very, very grateful that Oregon is considering this bill. I'm happy to have the opportunity to speak to you, and I really appreciate your attention, and I also would welcome the opportunity to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Nyman. We'll hear from Ms. Ireland.
Representative McPherson and committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Laura Ireland Moore, and I am an animal law attorney up in Portland, Oregon. And I apologize for any comments from my three-month-old daughter that may interrupt the session. I just want to point out that gestation crates only exist in Oregon because our anti-cruelty law exempts common husbandry practices. But just because gestation crates are common, it by no means doesn't mean that it's not cruel. I think if any of us saw our household pets kept in these sorts of conditions, we'd be horrified. But, you know, just because we classify dogs and cats as pets and pigs as food animals, it doesn't mean that they don't deserve the necessary protections from their cruelty. And pigs are more intelligent than dogs. They're just as emotional and social animals. And really what we should be asking for is the ability for them to experience sunlight and fresh air and grass and socialize with other pigs. But that's not even what this bill is asking for. It's only asking for the very basic protections of them be able to stretch their limbs and stand up. It's really, you know, the most basic of any animal's needs. And, you know, as our laws do reflect our values and our morals, and I think that this is a very important law to really ban this unnecessary and really inhumane practice. And I just wanted to point out two things that there's an article that was submitted in the Senate hearing regarding the economics of humane farming practices, that there is actually even more economical. And so if you would like to read that article, that is available in that hearing record. And also Susan Mentley, who is the operations manager of the Oregon Humane Society, is ill, and she asked me to submit her testimony, and so I have her written testimony for you to consider today as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ireland. Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, it's just a clarification on my earlier comment, Dr. Pete, that when I mentioned something about not being an issue in my district, I certainly didn't mean that it wasn't a concern of my constituents, many of whom I have heard from in support of this bill. I meant that pig farming was not any prevalent in my district. So just a clarification.
Thank you.
My constituents, all of them I've heard from support this bill. Just a clarification.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. And maybe any of the witnesses could answer the question. Is there a farm in Oregon that's doing this practice today?
I don't believe that's the case, that today that we are, that there are farms that do practice, that's practicing this. Gives us an opportunity to get ahead of the curve, perhaps.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Ms. Nyman, I read in a national magazine some months ago about an operation in Oregon. It was in the Eugene area, if I remember right, that is focused on sort of pork raised, I think, in the same manner that you're describing on the
It was probably the Laughing Stock Farm, guessing.
Okay. I mean,
It's not in our network, but if that's the farm you're referring to, I've heard of it, and they're...
But it seemed to, from what I recall from that article, it was a sort of the same market niche that you're describing, that is kind of specialty production that is shipped around to places because of the high quality and the awareness of humane practices.
I think that's right, and I would just say that we are currently in a niche, but our goal is eventually that all animals will be raised this way, and that, you know, I firmly believe that the type of practices that we're following become more common, the costs will come down with everything that we're doing. A lot of the costs are more when you don't have as many entities engaging in it, and when there isn't positive government support the way there is for conventional agriculture. But I would agree it's similar to what we're doing.
Okay. If there are no further questions, I'll excuse this panel. We have Walt Burke.
Good morning. Excuse me. Good morning, Chair McPherson and committee members. My name is Walter Burke. I'm out of Gresham, Oregon. I have a I have a 10 sow herd. I market about 150 animals a year. I raise breeding stock as well as market animals that go to slaughter. I'm here on behalf to against this bill. Gestation stalls are not used by the hog industry in the state of Oregon. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Pork Producers Board as well as myself as a pork producer. We know of no gestation stalls in the state of Oregon, and it's a shame that we're spending your time, my time, and everybody else's time here to pass a bill that doesn't need to be needed here in the state of Oregon. And gestation stalls are not in wide use in the hog industry in the United States. As you heard testimony earlier, Smithfield Foods, by 2012, is phasing them out. You will not be able to sell hogs to them. That means even me, as a breeder, raising breeding sows to sell to the people that are going to be raising the market hogs that you will eat. As myself, I cannot sell to that person because I have raised in gestation stalls. So therefore, that includes me too. So they're phasing them out by 2012. The National Pork Producers as an industry is in the process of phasing them out. We're also working very adamantly for the health and welfare of our animals. And if we didn't take care of our animals, we wouldn't have them to be producing, and so that's one reason why we are taking these steps. So therefore, I feel that this bill should be defeated and not be put before the committee here. So, and to bring up some of the other issues that were brought up this morning, there was a time when gestation stalls were used and farrowing stalls and farrowing crates were used, and that was part of this when this bill was into the Senate when they were proposing this, and it's been separated now. And yes, we do need our farrowing crates, but gestation stalls we do not need, and therefore I don't see why we should have a bill on the books in the state of Oregon. And to have factory farms come into the state of Oregon that would use these gestation stalls, that would not happen. Oregon does not have enough call, and we don't have packing houses to bring in these big production farms and stuff like that, to where somebody would put those in. It's just cost prohibitive to even put those in nowadays, and so that's why they're being phased out. There's not that much use throughout the country, so that's all I have. I'll be glad to answer questions if you have anything.
Any questions, Mr. Burke? Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Burke, for your testimony. Can you, in your testimony, you didn't comment again on the punishment. Your written testimony says you think that's too high.
Why should we have a punishment on a bill when, after 2012, we're not going to be able to use them? So therefore, why should we have punishment for it? I mean, if we're not going to be able to use them, and they're not being used in the state of Oregon, why do we need, the punishment?
And Mr. Burke, you indicated in your written testimony here that Smithfield Foods, which is the largest processor of meat hogs, is taking a position that they won't accept hogs that are raised in this manner. What do you have a sense of? Are they such a dominant part of the marketplace that no producer would be able to survive if they produced?
Smithfield Foods, yes, is one of the biggest hog slaughter plants in the United States. They've taken the stand, like the testimony you've heard. Burger King and that has all gone to them and said, we will not take animals that have been raised in gestation crates. So that's what Smithfield Foods is telling their producers, like myself, if I was to sell to them, they're telling me that I have to do away with it. All the rest of the packers and everybody else is following in the same steps, same guidelines, and they're phasing them out because we are trying to be consumer-friendly, do what the consumers want, more healthy, conscious, on our farms and stuff. And so we're all doing that. We're all having to find niche markets. The niche markets that I use, like the testimony before here, mine are that way too. There are certain antibiotics I can't use, hormones and stuff that nobody wants to use. So I have to abide by what my consumers and my customers want. And therefore, as a whole in the United States, the small producers like myself and others, we're having to abide by these and follow these guidelines as well as the larger producers. And so therefore, that's the industry trend, is to do with gestation crates. We're following the industry trends, following what the consumer wants, and that's how we're going about it.
Any questions for Mr. Burke? Thank you, sir.
Yep.
And our final witness is Barry Bashun.
Thank you. Representative McPherson, Chair McPherson, members of the committee, appreciate the opportunity to be here in front of you representing the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. I'm a third-generation farmer out of Boring, Oregon. For those of you that don't know, that's the gateway to Mount Hood. And I'm here representing the growers and agriculture as a whole. We are here to adamantly oppose this bill. I think it's unfortunate. I spend a lot of my time in the Capitol in front of agricultural committees and land use and environmental committees. I think it's unfortunate that we have to address an agricultural bill in a criminal manner like we have to do today. I think it's always unfortunate whenever we make or make laws that try to make criminals out of legitimate and honest farmers, and I think this bill does exactly that. With some discussion about Arizona and Florida and their ballot initiatives, I want you to keep in mind that those were heartstring votes. They were not votes based on science or knowledge of good farming practices. It's always easy to have social activists and proponents for bills to come forward and talk about the impacts on agriculture when few of them actually practice or make their living from agriculture. And I would like to point out that this is frankly nothing more than another in a line of significant and egregious bills and initiatives to try and put the livestock industry out of business in the United States. And I'm very concerned about that, and I hope that you recognize that for what it is. This bill would make criminals out of farmers using sound veterinary-endorsed animal husbandry practices, as endorsed by the American Veterinary Medical Association. And I hope you consider those standards as opposed to those in Europe or other states around the United States. Most pigs today are raised indoors to protect their health and safety in a controlled environment where weather and wild prey aren't a factor. This also provides a management condition where each animal's health can be monitored. It's been pointed out to you by a number of folks today that this is not a practice. Gestation pens are not a practice in Oregon.
Okay.
It seems to me particularly a waste of your time to try to deal with a bill to create a solution to a problem that does not exist. Some farmers choose to use pens, not gestation pens, but farrowing crates, and I realize they've been removed from this bill. Others choose to use individual stalls. Both are humane, according to the American Veterinary Medical Association. By prohibiting the confinement of a hog, this legislation would take the choice of what is best for their operations and animals away from Oregon farmers. I frankly respect the options and the marketing options that are available to folks in terms of some of the operations that have been mentioned. They are purely marketing opportunities, and any good farmer, any good businessman looks for marketing opportunities to increase the value of their product. However, that shouldn't mean that it sets a baseline standard for all other farmers that are merely trying to make a living in a difficult environment today. This allows for the restricted confinement of farrowing crates 7 days before the pig farrows. I know a number of you in here are probably either parents or maybe mothers or fathers. I wonder how successful you were in trying to guess the exact birth date of your child. On this one, if you're out more than 7 days, you become a criminal. And I think that's a bad precedent to set. All this legislation does is to allow proponents and well-funded New York socialites to use Oregon as a political pawn in a national agenda, even though our animal-based agriculture is completely different than many regions in the United States. It's always easy to talk about the economic impacts, and there was some impassioned pleas that we needed to look beyond those economic issues when we make these kind of rational decisions. Frankly, it's always easy to ignore economics when your bottom line doesn't rely upon the decisions that this legislature is faced with trying to make today. People keep their dogs in crates all day long, and I hear nothing about that from many of the proponents of this particular bill. People transport cats in cages all the time. They keep dogs chained up. I'm not saying these things are right, but we're not making them criminal. What we're trying to do here is to make farmers criminals and put the livestock industry out of business. I hope you recognize that. I hope you consider that and vote no and do not pass this bill onto the House. Thank you very much. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Mr. Bichu, let's set aside the sanctions. I think that does raise an issue, certainly in my mind, about whether a Class A misdemeanor is the appropriate way to approach this practice. So let's just assume we're just dealing with a regulatory change. I'm a little confused because what I was hearing from other sources here earlier is this is a practice that doesn't go on in Oregon and, in fact, is being really on the way out on a national basis. And I think I was hearing from you that this is a a practice that's supported by the American Veterinary Association and is regarded as humane. So I'm trying to figure out which is it. Is it, are we talking about a practice that really isn't done, is not done in Oregon and is on its way out on a national basis, or are we talking about something that is sort of regarded as an appropriate agricultural technique?
My understanding is that it's not done in Oregon or most other states. I cannot speak for what happens in the Midwest, where the entire pork-producing opportunities in Oregon are nothing more than a small farm and some of the Midwestern hog operations. I bristle a little bit when we start talking about factory farms. There are opportunities for a large number of agricultural practices in the United States, from a small family operation like mine to large family-owned corporate operations who, by the mere fact of increased regulation and increased input costs for agriculture, it becomes a matter of economics of scale. I do not know whether some of those other states use gestation pens. I am sure that the American Medical Association is referring to places where it may be used, and I would assume that legislatures would address those issues in their own manner in these other states. But I think it's irrelevant, frankly, to the state of Oregon with respect. I'm not saying your questions are irrelevant. I'm saying the answer is perhaps irrelevant because in Oregon it's not practiced, and we've spent an awful lot of the taxpayers' time trying to deal with something that doesn't exist.
Is there a business opportunity for Oregon farmers in having a regulation that's identified to the state that would restrict a practice which I think the public generally would say was not an appropriate practice? I'm thinking that the branding that has gone on around Oregon-grown chickens, for example, and that's I think been shown to be a preference for Oregon-grown poultry as compared to poultry that comes in from out of state. And I'm just wondering whether there's that same opportunity for pork products if we were to regulate this kind of practice so that there's a sort of a sense that it's being the animals are being raised differently here.
I don't believe so, sir. I mean, I think you heard Mr. Burt talk about farmers that are already taking opportunities of these market-driven processes. The market takes, I mean, I'm a firm believer in market-driven forces, and probably no one is better at taking advantage of markets than Oregon's wonderful farmers and ranchers. And I don't believe, and I in no way want to denigrate the public, but when you look at the number of people that take an active interest in the 3,000 or 4,000 bills that this great body looks at every year, I don't believe it has a significant impact on it whatsoever, and I think the market will drive that very well itself. And like, as you well know, farmers are more than happy to take opportunity of anything that will help their bottom line, which has not been great for the last 10 years.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Bichoux. It's very helpful to be reminded that we got to have some humility about how much people pay attention, people pay to what we do here. That is all the witnesses for Senate Bill 694. So I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 694 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 573. Council Stanford.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. Senate Bill 573 relates to pedestrians entering side crosswalks. ORS 811.028 creates a Class B traffic violation for drivers who fail to stop and remain stopped for pedestrians. Presently, the offense covers failure to stop and remain stopped for pedestrians who are proceeding in accordance with element one is they're either proceeding in accordance with a traffic control device or they're crossing a roadway in a crosswalk. That's element one. Then element two, the pedestrian must actually enter into the lane that the driver is in, a lane adjacent to the lane the driver is in, a lane into which the driver is turning, a lane adjacent to the lane into which the driver is turning, or a location less than 6 feet from the lane into which the driver is turning. Senate Bill 573A adds a different means for how a driver could violate the statute. If the driver does not stop and remain stopped for a pedestrian when the pedestrian is waiting on the curb or shoulder of the highway at a crosswalk and raising a hand and arm toward oncoming traffic. The primary motivation behind this change is that under present law, essentially, a pedestrian must actually take a step into the street in order to legally force vehicles to stop. Senate Bill 573A allows the pedestrian to stop traffic while remaining safely on the curb.
Thank you, Council. Senator Burdick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Again, I'm Ginny Burdick. I represent the people of Senate District 18.
and I'm a chief sponsor of Senate Bill 573. Basically, Senate Bill 573 is here to provide another, perhaps safer mechanism for a pedestrian to invoke their right to the right-of-way in a legal crosswalk. And I want to emphasize that it is legal crosswalks we're talking about and not anywhere else in this bill. Basically, as counsel said, right now a pedestrian has to be in the crosswalk before the traffic is required to stop and remain stopped until they get at least one lane away. This would allow the pedestrian to stand on the curb in a safer position and give a hand signal to invoke their right to have the traffic stop for them. It was a very interesting discussion in our Senate Judiciary Committee because when it comes to pedestrian laws, we tend to sometimes, some of us are both pedestrians and drivers a lot, and I'm in that category. Some people identify more with the plight of the pedestrian. Others tend to identify more with the plight of the driver who's trying to figure out what the heck they're supposed to do in any given situation. And this bill got consensus among the people who identify with the driver as well as the pedestrian because from the driver's standpoint, as they're driving down the road, and this is drivers who really want to do the right thing, they want to obey the law, they see a pedestrian on the curb, and they don't know what that person's intent is. And so sometimes a diligent driver, and I've done this myself, will stop to let the person cross, only to find out that they're waiting for the bus. Now, of course, legally, they're not required to stop when someone's on the sidewalk. This bill would give certainty about the pedestrian's intentions to the driver and would allow the pedestrian, because let's face it, drivers do drive down the street on cell phones. I'm glad this committee's addressing that. And sometimes they're distracted. Sometimes they don't see the pedestrian. And even if they mean well, sometimes they just blow by. And this allows the pedestrian to determine before they step out in front of traffic whether the traffic is indeed going to stop. So it's a way to improve the existing law. It got very strong bipartisan support in the Senate when it passed, both in the Judiciary Committee and on the floor. And I think it's a good constructive addition to our pedestrian law. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, I have about 30 questions.
Okay. Fire away.
But I'm only going to ask you one. I'll save the other for the other gentleman. I had some conversations with some ladies, and I have a real concern about this in rural Oregon, unlit intersections that do have crossworks, where a woman's alone in a car at night and she's going to have to stop that car. And I think that really puts women at risk at night where there's no police enforcement, there's no lights. You know, I would tell my wife specifically not to stop at that intersection unless with that person at the crosswalk was actually in the process of crossing, as a law now is, because I think it puts women really in jeopardy of rape and carjacking.
Well, Representative Krieger, I spend a lot of time as a woman in a car, and I certainly believe that anyone in a car these days needs to take great care to lock their doors and to be very vigilant in situations like this. I think that's the solution to this, because, in fact, if the person is in the crosswalk, like just barely in the crosswalk, they have to stop anyway. This really wouldn't change that. In fact, it might even give a better sense of what that person's intentions are.
Any further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Senator. So our crosswalks, only those painted where they're painted crosswalks.
No, actually, the definition of a legal crosswalk is more extensive than that. So if you have an intersection, the point from one curb to another is also a legal crosswalk. I think one of the things that I've noticed after the initial law was passed in 2003 I have noticed more painted crosswalks, and I really think that's a very positive thing because it makes it very clear to everyone where the crosswalk is.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, then thank you, Senator.
We're now going to bring a panel forward. Scott Bricker, Mike Dennis, Ray Thomas, and Lynn Lindgren-Schender, I think.
Chair McPherson, members of the Judiciary Committee, for the record, my name is Scott Bricker. I'm the policy director at the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. I like to be surrounded by good music. I also work with the Willamette Pedestrian Coalition, and we have a panel here of folks that are from the Willamette Pedestrian Coalition, the Bicycle Transportation Alliance, and actually I'm going to request to have another opportunity to get up and do a short video presentation for your feature presentation, but I'll pass it off to Mike Dennis here. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Mike Dennis. Thank you, Chair McPherson and committee members. I have some written testimony here to hand out to you all. I am a volunteer with the Willamette Pedestrian Coalition, and I'm here representing our group and our members, expressing our support for Senate Bill 573. The Willamette Pedestrian Coalition is dedicated to promoting walking and making conditions for walking safe and attractive. We were launched in 1991 as one of the first organizations in the country focused on pedestrians, and have been involved in many programs in the Portland area and statewide, such as the Walk to School Day, where 20,000 Oregon school children were encouraged to learn how to walk safely to school with their parents, such as the Oregon Coalition for Promoting Physical Activity, and Share the Road Safety Class. So we have a very good law for pedestrians on the books right now with the Stop and Stay Stopped law. The Willamette Pedestrian Coalition worked with others in 2003 to pass Senate Bill 315, which, as Senator Burdick had said, all drivers must stop and stay stopped for pedestrians in crosswalks and public street intersections. In 2005, we worked with many different partners to help improve that, to improve Stop and Stay Stop, to make it easier for drivers to turn at red lights. And now we are here before you to suggest and encourage you to take this other minor improvement, the hand signal legislation, which we believe would make it safer for children, families, seniors, and all walkers by creating a simple, intuitive way to increase communication between drivers and walkers, and to really create predictability between the two different groups. This law would eliminate a catch-22 where pedestrians currently must step into a crosswalk with cars to lawfully exercise their right to cross the intersection. The hand signal would be a clear signal before a pedestrian steps into a crosswalk to safely get out there and avoid having to step into the path of approaching vehicles to enact one's lawful right to cross at an intersection. So just in conclusion, we think that this makes it safer and easier for walking. Walking has great benefits in providing a safer space for walkers, will save lives. There are far-reaching health benefits, and we believe economic benefits too, as well, to walking, in activating business districts and reducing congestion by removing cars from the road to increase road capacity for freight traffic and automobiles and commuters. So in conclusion, the legislature has made a strong commitment to public safety, and we urge you to consider passage of Senate Bill 573A. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dennis.
If I may, I was hoping to do the short video here.
Yes. Let's hear the video and hear from everybody in the panel before we open it for questions.
Hope this works. If not, then let's see. If not, we could go on to Ray and try and make this.
Okay. Wait. Thomas, do you want to present while they're queuing that up?
Good morning. My name is Ray Thomas, and I'm a member of the Bicycle Transportation Legislative Committee and a lawyer and educator with human power as my area of focus in my practice. I have written materials which, while they're not as graphic as the video, may assist you in seeing some photos that present the problem and how it is that SB 573 provides a common sense practical solution. If I may, I'll pass the materials around. As I thought about this bill and this hearing this morning, I thought that this group in this room probably needs no further example than what exists right outside this building when you cross the street in front of the Capitol building, because there you have a multi-lane roadway with a marked crosswalk. And this morning before I came in, I just watched for a few minutes and saw a number of examples of why it is that this bill is necessary. We're at the point in Oregon now where the law is clear that pedestrians have the right of way in marked and unmarked crosswalks. The problem is that it's not clear to motorists when it is that they really, really have to stop. And for law enforcement officials, it's very difficult for them to actually observe and cite violations, because most pedestrians are too timid and too smart to step out in the roadway in order to trigger their right-of-way. Because if they step out into the roadway, they're in the killing zone in front of the motor vehicles who are coming toward them. And in fact, the reason that I use the example in front of the building as a good one is that this is the seat of legislative, judicial, and executive power in the state of Oregon, with more visible police cars than just about any place I know. And yet I see people in suits who are obviously legislators trying to cross the roadway, and they have the right-of-way, they're standing in the roadway, and cars are not stopping, they're zooming by on their way down toward the Willamette River. The problem with the current law is that there is not a clear way to teach people who are school kids or for adults to exercise their right-of-way. And what SB 573 does is provide an example that will work. And the reason it'll work is because it's quite identifiable. All the person has to do is, either while on the curb or standing immediately off of the curb, is raise their arm and put it in a position where the motorist can see that the pedestrian is exercising their right of way. There was a question raised about, well, does that subject somebody to possible safety problems? Well, the thing is if you're going to carjack somebody, you could go to a rural stop sign and carjack somebody. And further, if you're in a place where you have to stop for a pedestrian, you can do what the rest of us do at night when we're kind of by ourselves, and that is you can lock the doors in your car and roll up the windows before you stop. Do we have it now?
Yes, you can wrap up.
Okay. So we hope that this will show you some good examples of how it is that we're trying to coexist with motorists on the roadway, and we, if you have questions, we can be available to answer.
Okay, and again, for the record, I'm Scott Bricker, and I hope that this works the way, you know, we'll see that we are. But so we'll start this. So walking is good. Walking is good for business districts. Walking is.
There you go.
If we could start this again. Good for our business districts. Good for our health. Good for our families, our children. Walking already has an existing set of laws. There are times when you can legally cross, and times when you're not supposed to cross, and sometimes people do anyway. What this bill does is it tries to create some clarity. I don't know who this guy is, but what is he doing? One of the things that we heard from senators on the floor is that there is concern about people who are milling around in a place that you would consider be a place that you would want to cross the street, having cars stopping for someone who is really pondering the meaning of life. The pedestrian hand signal bill would help clarify that. Right now, there are cases where people are trying to cross the street where technically cars should be stopping for them, like right here, This is, but however, but there are opportunities, and I'm going to try and just do this again here, where you have a four-lane street, someone who's out in the roadway using a hand signal to clarify to motorists, another hand signal. One thing that you actually do here is with the stop and say stop laws, you use those cars that are coming at me, that's me, as a shield, and then put a stop signal to the other folks. That whole process took about 7 seconds, and the cars in the first lane that stopped were moving within three to four seconds, and that's Hawthorne Boulevard, four lanes of traffic. So this is actually something that we believe will facilitate vehicle movement. Let's see, do I have? And so that we think is an actual efficient use. That the communication, our roadways are about predictability, and if we can create communication between motorists and vehicle users, that someone could actually facilitate their way across the road quickly. One of the things this bill, and was already talked about, does is that you can't just step out in front of cars. You have to choose the right time to do this. But when a pedestrian feels like it's safe to do it, they can use their hand signal and facilitate safe passage and efficient roadway operation. We're hoping that this bill will do that. Thank you.
Questions? Representative Krieger.
Good example of one of my concerns is your very picture here. Top one, second page. Handout. We don't know how long he's been at the intersection because it says is waiting. Is that a second? A minute? If that car is doing a speed limit of 20 to 25 and it's somewhere within about 30 feet of the intersection, he puts up his hand. Is that car going to be required to stop, slam on his brake, and slide into the person? I mean, it's not describing any distances. And what's going to happen there, if that person steps out, by law, that car is in violation because the guy's got his hand up. But technically, if he's doing 25 miles an hour, it's physically impossible to stop.
Yeah, Chair McPherson, Representative Krieger, and maybe we could find the statute for this, but under the current stop and stay stop law, it is true that if you're a pedestrian in the crosswalk, in this particular example, you would have the right of way. There are also laws, however, that govern how pedestrians can go out into the crosswalk. You're, as a pedestrian, you're not legally allowed to just step out in front of vehicles. And that's typically what will happen. Even if you have the right of way in the crosswalk, if you step in front of a car, and you just jump out in front of a car, there are laws that prohibit you from doing that. So there is built into the system already a reasonableness measure. And this would apply. This doesn't create any new places where pedestrians can cross the street. It doesn't create really any new provisions except for the fact that, and it also would leave the reasonableness measure in there. So it would state that, this person, that's an appropriate question here. And if we had video, if I had more footage, I would be able to show cases where it was appropriate and then where it wasn't appropriate.
Representative Barker. Thank you. I briefly spoke with you yesterday. Cars, the signals are set up so to facilitate the flow of traffic. And I can see a place like Hawthorne where every street is a crosswalk. Every intersection, rather, is a crosswalk, whether it's painted or not. And I can just see the traffic flow just being completely disrupted in Portland, on Lombard, on these other streets where traffic proceeding at the speed, makes the lights. And now some stop anyway, but this would mean any kid, everybody, waving their hand. It just, this to me looks like the, and I, well-intended, and sincerely well-intended, but it reminds me of the school speed law that we passed in 2003 that the public went nuts over once that was passed. And that was the Safe Child Bill or something, so everybody who could vote against the Safe Child Bill. And they voted against it next time because the public went crazy. I just think this would be really disruptive to allow pedestrians to control traffic on every intersection everywhere in the state.
Representative Pearson and Vice Chair Barker, if I may, just real briefly. One of our video footage was shot on Hawthorne, 6:30 in the evening, so it wasn't peak period, but it was relatively busy times. The facilitation, actually what I'm experiencing as someone who works on these issues daily, is that the communication and to facilitate, it's like merging into traffic. As a car, you're not allowed to just merge into traffic anywhere, but if you have your turn signal on and you're fitting within traffic, cars will let you in and you will facilitate the operational flow. Right now, pedestrians, the law is set up for pedestrians to be able to cross the street, and in places like Hawthorne, in fact, there are a number of new curb extensions that were recently put down that the city is actually trying to create and facilitate more crossing, because that's one of the big problems. It's a major business district, and businesses are complaining about people not being able to cross the street. I understand your concerns, and in many cases, on the busiest streets, there already are traffic lights and things that would govern this. So from our standpoint, this helps actually increase efficiency and safety and doesn't clog the streets.
Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope that you can address one of my concerns, and I do agree with Representative Barker that this is very well-intentioned. But say, for example, somebody's visiting, and they don't know that that's a hand signal, and they're trying to, for example, hail a cab, or some of the drivers, let's say this passes, and the drivers become accustomed to that, but they don't know that this person is from out of state or doesn't know other requirements, so they think, well, they must not be crossing the street because their hand isn't up, and they keep going. And I understand that they'd be violating the current law under that situation, but if drivers think that everybody who's crossing the street has to put their hand up and somebody doesn't put their hand up, and they think they're not crossing, so they continue on. So I hope you can address that issue.
This is Ray Thomas, and I'd like to address that and the other question as well by Representative Barker. This bill does not add to the cluster of rights that pedestrians have at all. Before this bill, pedestrians had the right of way in marked and unmarked crosswalks. All this bill does is to create another way, a clear and visible way, that a pedestrian can indicate that they're wanting to exercise those rights. And so in a situation where a driver is from another place, the way that the statute operated before the addition of SB 573 is that when that pedestrian steps off that crosswalk, the right-of-way is triggered and they have the right-of-way. This just adds a way to make it more clear with that visible signal that the pedestrian is indeed intending to do it. And one of the nice things about 573 is that it creates a nice way to teach kids who are wanting to cross streets, to go to school and to go to places, how it is that they can raise their hand and have the right-of-way and see that the cars are going to stop before they step off of the curb and into the roadway. So this is something that we feel does not really change the balance of power or the legal relationship between the cars and pedestrians. It just provides a more visible, clear signal of the pedestrian's intentions.
Representative Krieger, and we have two more bills we had set for hearing, so I was hoping to get on to them, so if we could come to a conclusion.
Well, just briefly then, how does this change from the current law the responsibility of a person at a crosswalk as far as not every place is at a 20-mile-an-hour speed zone, so they're out there in a 40 or 45 with a crosswalk where we have in rural Oregon. How are they going to calculate that speed of that vehicle and whether it's appropriate at that time to put their hand up and try to make that car stop? And that is kind of in line with line 22 of the bill. It says waiting on the curb or shoulder. Waiting how long? They walk up and sit there. Is that a wait? They've got to be there 30 seconds. There's a lot of unknowns about what right they can invoke and how long they've had to be there in order to do this. And we have many, Mr. Chair, unlighted crosswalks in rural communities that I just think that that picture, you know, on the back page there, and there's nothing within the bill that I see that shows a way of educating either drivers or pedestrians, and pedestrians who don't have driver's license aren't going to be looking at the motor vehicle code. I think there's a lot of
things need to be fixed in this bill.
Committee, I think we need to move on to some other bills, but just I will just note here so that the witnesses will be aware of this, that council had pointed out something that's probably an unintended result, but the way that the A and Gross bill reads now, it looks as though it would allow a pedestrian to trump a traffic signal. And I think, sure, that's not intended, but it looks to me, just on a quick look here, and that's the case, and that's obviously something that would need to be fixed as well. So we've got, I see somebody else who's joined
with
this
table
here. Yeah, I'm
sorry, Chairman McPherson. We were hoping that she could testify, and it was actually, we were a panel and coming in as an individual citizen. Is it possible to make it brief? Or
boy, just really with just a minute or two. I mean, we've got to move on.
We appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Lynn Lindgren Schroeder. This is Charlotta. We live in Northeast Portland. I'm an architect, a pedestrian advocate, and a parent. I like to walk, and I want my children to learn to love their city by walking. Excuse me. I also want them and everyone else to feel safe as they travel around their city on foot. That is why I'm here to speak to you about Senate Bill 573. As an architect, I support this bill. It will help people feel comfortable walking. And the more people we have walking in our cities, the better places they are. But it's as a parent that this bill really hits home. How many of you, when you are walking with children, have stepped into a crosswalk to signal a driver your intent to cross? I haven't. It's legal, but children are too young to understand the signs they need to look for when a car is coming when they're in the street. Children need something clear and familiar, something you can invoke from the safety of a sidewalk curb, something like raising your hand. Children understand that when you want someone's attention, you raise your hand. So raising your hand to cross the street makes sense to children. And in my opinion, as a walker and a parent, it makes sense for all pedestrians. Thanks.
Thank you, Ms. Schroeder. Very good. That concludes our testimony on Senate Bill 573. I will now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 331. And counsel out of the room, well, I guess here's counsel and can give us an introduction. But why don't you come forward, gentlemen? We have Dan Floyd, Rick Whitten, and Sean Miller. And, gentlemen, unfortunately, we have to be on the floor at 10, and so if you could, I'd like to conclude the work on this at quarter till, so we still have time to hear from people on the last bill.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, Senate Bill 331A relates to the crime of organized retail theft. It creates a new Class B felony. Oregon presently divides most theft offenses by dollar value. First-degree theft is a Class C felony. It applies for stolen items valued at or over $750. Second-degree theft is a Class A misdemeanor. It applies for stolen items valued at between $50 and $750. Third-degree theft is a Class C misdemeanor. It's at items less than $50. There's also the crime of aggravated first-degree theft, a Class B felony, which applies for stolen items in a single or aggregate transactions at $10,000 or higher. Retail merchants have recently reported organized thefts involving multiple persons, and oftentimes these persons are associated with illegal drugs or methamphetamine, in which persons steal various items, oftentimes batteries, baby formula, things like that, from stores, with the purpose of later reselling these items at venues such as flea markets or other venues. The persons intentionally keep the value of the item stolen from a particular store on a particular day at or below $750, relatively low amounts, stay at the misdemeanor level, but with multiple people and in the aggregate, the values add up. Persons then would hit the same or different store the following day or week. Then all of the stolen items are sold together at the secondary market. Senate Bill 331A creates a new crime of organized retail theft to capture this conduct and to punish it at the felony level. To be guilty of organized retail theft, the state must establish, first of all, the person stole merchandise, that this was stolen from a mercantile establishment, which is defined, the person acted in concert with another person, and the aggregate value of the merchandise within a 90-day period exceeds $5,000. Senate Bill 331A also places organized retail theft within Oregon's racketeer-influenced and corrupt organizations, otherwise known as RICO statute.
Thank you, counsel. And Ms. Brandis, you were signed up as well, and I realized that you had organized this panel here. Will you be presenting as well? Why don't you, if you're going to speak, why don't you join them? Because we've got a very limited time, and I want to make sure we're using it most efficiently.
And if you wanted to do any introductory remarks for this panel or concluding remarks, very good.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dan Floyd, representing the Northwest Grocery Association. I will give you the brief version of already brief testimony. I want our guests to have a chance to speak. This bill passed out of the Senate Judiciary Committee unanimously and then on the Senate floor 30-0. Organized retail crime is a huge issue for us, and it hurts our industry to the extent of $30 billion annually across the nation. Safeway, which is here today to speak, loses $130 million a year regionally and $10 million a year in the state of Oregon alone. As you will hear from Safeway, this crime is different from petty shoplifting. It's not like stealing a pack of gum or a soda. This is thousands of dollars of merchandise that was stolen from retailers throughout this state. And it's not just grocery retailers, but it's all retailers. Our association represents over 1,100 retail locations, and those are just 1,100 of the many locations that are being hit right now. This bill will separate this from petty shoplifting, and it's going to provide us with the tool that we need to go after these kinds of organized gangs. This is organized crime. I was going to speak more. I'm going to pass it on to Rick Winn from Safeway right now. He's going to go over the mechanics of the crime. Sean Miller is going to explain to you why we're at this version of the bill and how we got to that with the work group and the Senate side. Thank you.
Okay. Chairman McPherson, distinguished members of the committee, thank you for allowing us to speak to you on this bill today. My name is Rick Whidden. I'm the Director of Loss Prevention for Safeway's 118th store, Oregon and Southwest Washington Division. I will be brief. Organized retail crime is the largest security problem facing our industry. It has reached epidemic proportions and is growing every single day. Our teams and citizens and shoplifters and criminals, ravenous to feed their daily habits, are entering our stores. These are career criminals. They're entering our stores often in teams using bags, foil, lookouts, number of other tools to defeat the security measures that we put in place and steal thousands of dollars every single day. This crime is driven by a virtual limitless demand for these products on online sites such as eBay, Craigslist, and secondary illegitimate markets. These teams travel from store to store, sometimes up to 8 to 10 in a day, and sometimes travel in from other states, stealing within Oregon. These criminals are career criminals and will stop at nothing to commit their crimes, oftentimes using violence against our employees and customers. Although Safeway has spent millions of dollars trying to protect our product and investigate these crimes, we simply do not have the tools to address this specific crime. We work very closely with law enforcement, and we believe Senate Bill 331 addresses this and separates this problem, giving a $5,000 threshold within 90 days, keeping the cost of doing business crime of shoplifting at the appropriate levels, and addressing the criminals involved in this organized fashion at a much higher stature. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Whitten. Yeah. Mr. Miller.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sean Miller, representing the Northwest Grocery Association. Just wanted to bring you back to last session when the House and the Senate negotiated the meth package, probably the most comprehensive crime package to deal with the meth epidemic in Oregon. And I know the House and Senate and those, both Republicans and Democrats who negotiated that package, wanted to and had an agreement to look back at other issues, things that spun off of that package that would be looked at in future legislatures. This bill, Senate Bill 331, is a result of that, and because of the meth epidemic and the people feeding their daily habits, you all last session tried to get at the folks who were making meth in their homes, and you did a very successful job at that. Unfortunately, these folks are still having to buy their meth. The way they buy it is they come into our stores and through organized retail crime are able to obtain the merchandise, resell it, and then satisfy their fix. We want to get at a tool to try to get at that issue within Senate Bill 331. The Governor's Methamphetamine Task Force, Mr. Chairman, Rob Bovet could not be here. He was instrumental in last session's bill. I wanted just to state for the record that obviously he's supportive of the bill, and the Governor's Methamphetamine Task Force is also supportive of this bill, as well as law enforcement. the Sheriff's Association has, and the Chiefs of Police. And in the Senate, we initially came in with this bill at a 180-day period and an aggregate value of $1,000. And through negotiation, the chairman, Senator Burdick, authorized Senator Prezansky to form a work group on this. Senator Prezansky then, through the negotiations and through that work group, came up with a compromise of a 90-day period and $5,000. And so, you know, we're here to honor that, what we feel is a good compromise. And originally when we came in with this, the values, we wanted to mirror what Washington passed last session. So our original bill mirrors that. But we have been willing to compromise to the levels that you see in the A and Gross version of Senate Bill 331. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer. Thank you.
Representative Krieger. Well, I first of all think $5,000 is too much. And I haven't read this like I should have. It says in the aggregate within 90 days, so that would be a group or individual in that 90 days.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Krieger, the bill states that it's people that are, let me find the line here. It has to be, essentially, 90-day period is, as it could be a group of individuals within the $5,000 limit. That is, you know, stealing merchandise, and what they'll do, as Rick indicated, is they'll go down and they'll steal from Safeway, Fred Meyer, Winco, and they'll just go down the list. Within that 90-day period, we felt that most of the crimes, at least a lot of the crimes, would fall in that $5,000 limit. Now, would we like to have it lower? The answer is yes, but because the Senate was in a compromise effort, we are willing to accept this limit. And it gives us that tool to, I think, still go after these.
Representative Cameron. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there some arrest been made that you could tell us about, or some examples of where law officers have actually, securities actually followed some people and would have been able to prosecute them under this new law recently?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, actually I had provided a Safeway example within my testimony, so I'll let them fill in some of the blanks. But yes, indeed, there was a large Portland ring primarily associated in Clackamas County. Safeway was the store that alerted the retailers to this. And I think it's important to note that Safeway and the retailers that I represent, like Home Depot and Target, often hire private investigative teams to help with the local law enforcement to put the cases together. That was done. Also important to note is loss prevention officers in our stores have their own trade association statewide, so they often get together and talk about what's going on and what to look for. Anyway, the merchandise was being sold by Happy Deal Grocery, and I know Representative Barker is familiar with this. And this one ring, the estimate was that this one ring was responsible for about $15 million of loss from stores in the Clackamas County area. And there's sweepers and boosters. Those are the people who come in and sweep off your shelves and then get the product out into the market. And the ring was associated all the way from here to Florida, I believe. Do you want to add anything to that?
Mr. Chair, follow up if I may. How were those people prosecuted, and what happened to them?
They were prosecuted under federal statutes. Unfortunately, we've had a very difficult time over the years. Working with local law enforcement has been very frustrated because, unfortunately, under current statutes, they're only prosecuted under shoplifting misdemeanor crimes. So understanding the scope of the problem, we went federal law enforcement when we knew it was going out over state lines. Certainly local law enforcement is very receptive to prosecuting these crimes. Unfortunately, there's nothing on the books today that allows them to target the scope of the problem.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Krieger, if I can answer, I was looking for, in Section 2, to get to your question, it says a person commits the crime of organized retail theft if, and then comma, acting in concert with another person. I think that's the difference between the someone just going in and shoplifting versus the ring of people who set up in the aisles. They have cell phones. They make sure people's not watching. They fill their carts.
they run out the door, and they sometimes throw the whole cart in the van, and then boom, they're gone off to the next door. And that's kind of that's the difference in the petty shoplifting versus the organized retail crime.
If I could give one quick example, a recent example, a current case that's pending, we have a individual who on a daily basis is stealing anywhere between $1,800 and $2,500 worth of wine. He has been arrested. He's gone to Safeway and Kroger's and Hagen's. He's been arrested pending trial, out on his own release. He kept up stealing $2,500 worth of wine for every single store that he went into. Currently, he will be prosecuted under petty shoplifting crime, and this is somebody who we estimate alone is stealing well over $1 million worth of wine by himself.
Committee, we have one people who've come on another bill who have waited patiently through this this period. We're going to have to be gone at 10. So what I propose we do is that we roll over the remainder of this hearing until Monday, and I'm looking at the other people who are signed up, Andrea Meyer and Ann Christian, to make sure that they can be here on Monday to present on this bill. So what I'll do then is to close the public hearing on, or we'll continue, roll over the remainder of the public hearing on Senate Bill 331A, and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 464A. And the first three witnesses are people who I think may not be regularly in the building: Sheriff Todd Anderson, Captain Jeff Groff, and Dan Tennell. So let's hear from counsel as an introductory, and then we'll hear from those witnesses, and then we'll be done for the day.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, Senate Bill 464A relates to a creation of a Class B felony of aggravated identity theft. I believe it came from did not come from the Senate Judiciary Committee. Senate Committee on Commerce is where it came from. ORS 165.800, which is existing law, creates the Class C felony of identity theft. The elements of this offense, in short, are: person has the intent to deceive or defraud; that person obtains, possesses, converts to the defendant's own use the personal identification of someone else. Personal identification includes a broad array of written documents or electronic data. Senate Bill 464A expands this offense by creating aggravated identity theft, which is a Class B felony as opposed to a Class C felony. Elements of aggravated identity theft include basically committing identity theft 10 or more times in 180 days, committing identity theft and the amount is over $10,000 in any 180-day period, and the amount of damage, or committing identity theft where the defendant has 10 or more pieces of identification from 10 or more different persons.
Gentlemen, I'll let you pick the order in which you speak. Just recognize that we have 10 minutes before we have to walk out.
Chairman Pearson and members of the committee, my name is Dan Tennell. I'm an attorney in Portland and former Washington County Deputy District Attorney for 6 years. I've been in private practice for 2 years, and I was honored when Sheriff Ramirez of Marion County asked me to chair the RESIC Legislative Committee this year. This bill is the product of our committee, along with a package of three other bills. This session, the origination of this bill, although I would like to claim it was mine uniquely, but I know that anybody that's prosecuted a number of large-scale identity theft and fraud crimes for any length of time in a prosecutor's office would realize the current limits upon the existing identity theft statute. In a moment, Captain Groth from the Tualatin Police Department is going to talk about a case study of a very large identity theft case that, along with his members, I prosecuted when I was in the DA's office. We felt, the RESIC Legislative Committee and the RESIC Foundation Board felt, that we needed to give police and prosecutors a tool that would make more efficient, more costly, and allow for cross-jurisdictional prosecutions of identity theft. Our bill provides that multi-incident, multi-profile identity theft situations can be aggregated and consolidated into one county, into one prosecution. It will alleviate a person having to be prosecuted in multi-counties, as Captain Groth will talk about. There were four counties involved in this bill. It also provides for the same length of incarceration as aggravated theft and burglary in the first degree. It amends the venue provision in Oregon statutes to make identity theft cross-jurisdictional, as is theft. And, for instance, if someone had committed identity thefts in three metro counties, there would be three district attorney's offices, three defense attorneys, three jails, and three probation officers if there were ultimately convictions. This bill passed unanimously in the Senate, 25-0, out of Senator Prozanski's committee. After our initial testimony, we had a work group make some consolidations and agreements in the bill that has drawn the, I would like to say, praise but support of the Oregon Criminal Defense Attorney Association. There was no objections to this bill in the Senate, and I know of none here today. So with that, I will turn it over to Sheriff Anderson.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, I'm Todd Anderson, the sheriff from Tillamook County. I'm representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association and a couple of sheriffs who really wanted to be here today. Sheriff Ramirez, who I know many of you are aware, had open heart surgery last week, and Sheriff Evinger. This is a bill that both of these sheriffs and the association think is a tool in the box for law enforcement to address identity theft. I think most of the members of the committee are aware that identity theft closely connected to methamphetamine use and drug use. We see this as a extremely efficient way of the criminal justice system prosecuting these individuals. You know, when there's an opportunity to save, you know, one, two, or three different counties from prosecuting the same individual on the same kind of conduct, what that means is jury time, judicial time. You know, we look at court-appointed attorneys. That individual would probably have separate court-appointed attorney in every one of those counties, and so what this is, besides a tool to law enforcement, it's a tool to the state to save dollars in prosecuting these crimes that are so prevalent today. I'm going to keep my comment short and let the captain speak about a specific case today. So thank you.
Good morning, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. Thank you for your time this morning. I'm Jeff Groth. I'm a captain with the Tualatin Police Department, and I've been a police officer for over 17 years. I'm representing this morning not only the men and women of the Tualatin Police Department, but also the thousands of men and women police officers that deal with identity theft on a daily basis. In addition, Kevin Campbell was here on behalf of OACP, but for the sake of time, he's allowing me to tell you that the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police is in support of this bill as well. I want to just really quickly profile for you one Tualatin police case. It is case number 042418. It's a 2004 case. You have a remnant, a portion. This is the entire case. You have just a small section of that in front of you. That case involved one suspect, at least five different police agencies, two states, and four separate counties within the state of Oregon, and well over 300 victims of identity theft. The segment that I provided you this morning is the list that lists all the victims involved in this case. This case began with a person notifying our police agency that another person, a convicted ID thief, was preparing to be released from custody and was believed to have a storage unit full of items related to identity theft. The investigation was started by Officer Molly Pfaff of our agency. She contacted numerous agencies, traced several forged checks, and was able to identify some victims. She was able to establish probable cause for the search of the storage unit. The storage unit was searched, and inside that storage unit was over 300 profiles, as they are known as, in addition to remnants of an old methamphetamine lab. Officer Pfaff then began the arduous task of locating and identifying the victims, processing the evidence, preparing the case for prosecution, and that lasted for at least, if not more than, 6 months. It was a tremendous drain on her time and on the resources of the department. The case was eventually submitted and prosecuted by Dan Tunnell, as he referenced, in the Washington County District Attorney's Office. The victims were targeted via all the usual means of personal identification, a driver's license, bank statement, so on, as well as through an AFSCME roster, a City of Portland employee list, college loan documents, and Oregon health plan documents. At least one of the profiles involved was that included the identity of a deceased person. What was learned from this case is that identity thieves don't take the profiles, use them, and then throw them away. Rather, they retain them, store them, trade them, sell them, and otherwise make them available for future use. Unfortunately, this case is not unusual, and the numbers of victims that this case represents is not unusual. Cases with multiple, sometimes even hundreds of victims, have become the rule rather than the exception in the case of ID theft. More help is clearly needed in our fight against ID theft, and this law will provide us with greater ability to combat what has become a scourge for our state. And I thank you for your support of this bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you. I'll be brief. Thank you very much. I have a comment for Captain Groth. I support this bill. I think it's great. I am more than a bit concerned about the fact that you've just introduced into the testimony and into the public record a document that contains hundreds of names, addresses, including some Social Security numbers and credit card numbers. So I ripped the first page and the second page off. I'm putting it in my bill file, and I'm returning the rest of it to you, and I encourage everybody else to do the same. Okay.
Able. So
thank you.
You caught that just like you did. So.
Okay. So I please take the first page and the special report page off, and let's return this.
My intent was to make copies of the... I have two different sections, and the one that I intended to make copies of did not have the Social Security numbers on it.
This has dates of birth, driver's license numbers, credit card numbers, and some Social Security numbers. So let's return it. Thank you.
Okay. I appreciate that.
Your vigilance, Representative. We're just about at our closing time. Any final questions for this panel? If not, thank you very much, gentlemen, for bringing this forward. Sorry you had to wait as long as you did in order to present.
Okay, thank you.
I'll close there until we roll over until Monday, the continuation of the public hearing on Senate Bill 464. And close then the meeting of the House Judiciary Committee for the 18th. Thank you.